Okay, good evening, and thanks. And thanks for coming. First of all, we're sponsored, as always, by Debbie Sondheim in honor of our parents, Heinz and Nina Sondheim, and in honor of the marriage of Akiva Adler to Rebecca Elephant. Mazel. Okay, this is it for us, the third and final lecture. I admit, the three was just because I only had 3 weeks. It turns out there's more to say, but hopefully by the end of tonight we'll have covered the fundamental points. Quick recap. The first week we talked about what we called the history of Tanakh study and how we went in cycles from when Klal Yisrael were focused on Tanakh, everybody knew Tanakh, if they called you up for an aliyah in shul, you got up and laned because you knew it. Then perhaps because of Christianity we backed away from Tanakh and sort of ceded ground to them. Then we took it back again, then Siddukim and Karaim and Bible critics and back and forth, and we sketched out periods in which Tanakh study was a focus for Klal Yisrael, and then when it was not. And where we sort of ended was, you know, you had like the 100-year period into the 1900s where Tanakh, if not forgotten, was certainly not a focus in any yeshiva, and you had Jews returning to the land of Israel, and you had first non-religious Jews, Chilonim, focused on Tanakh and what it meant to them. And then, after the Six-Day War, you really had, for the first time in a few hundred years, you know, Sabbath-observing Jews, Talmidei Chachamim, focused again on Tanakh. And that's what we refer to, and people refer to, as the Tanakh Revolution, and it's going on now. Last week, we focused on the question of whether, well, the place of nuance in Tanakh. For example, are there Tzaddikim and Rishayim, or are there Rishayim with redeeming qualities, and Tzaddikim who from time to time make mistakes? Obviously that's an oversimplified description of what we talked about and the Machlokes, but certainly it is the case that people who identify with the new focus in Tanakh are more willing to see nuance in biblical figures, in Abraham, in Yitzchak, in Yaakov, in Moshe, in David HaMelech, and the people who are less comfortable with it basically say, if Chazal didn't see it, I didn't see it. What we pointed out last week was Chazal saw many of these nuances. They're just not as well known. Those Ma'amari Chazal are not as well known for any number of reasons. One of them being Rashi didn't quote the nuanced Ma'amari Chazal. Rashi has good guys and bad guys. He's Rashi. He's allowed to do it. He may have believed it. He may have done it for other purposes. And the other is we grow up loving certain people. And so who wants to hear anything negative about somebody we love? Certainly I don't. Okay? That's the briefest summary of the last 2 weeks. But having talked about this Tanakh Revolution, it seems like now's the time to ask, okay, if you belong to this Tanakh Revolution, how do I learn Tanakh? Right? What's so unique about what's going on now? What's so special? If I want to start learning Tanakh, how do I do it? So, it would be very, very hard to, in a half an hour, 45 minutes, you know, describe everything associated with how people are learning Tanakh now, but there are three or four core points that I think we can focus on that will help us get a sense for what we mean by the Tanakh Revolution and what people are doing now, primarily in Israel. Here's the bad news. There's no shortcut. Meaning, if you ask somebody like Rav Yoel ben Nun, who's, you know, one of the three or four leaders of what's going on in Tanakh now in the state of Israel, he'll tell you, first of all, you need to know Tanakh. You need Bikiyus in Tanakh. You need to learn it. It's just like nobody who just knows one Mishnah in Kedushin would get up and give a shiur on Kedushin, because what would you do if the next Mishnah contradicted what you're saying? You need some fundamental knowledge to say anything. So it's not really possible to know only one Pasuk or one Parsha and start saying fancy things if it turns out that there are other Pasukim and other Parshios that give color and context to it and you don't know them. So the first step is Bikiyus in Chumash, in Tanakh. It goes quickly, by the way. You can read stuff really quickly and get a sense for it and feel comfortable with it. And that's the foundation for anything you're ever going to do in Tanakh. But that was the easy part. The second part is what he says, asking real questions. Okay, one of the worst habits we have is we always assume there's a reason why something appears twice. So we're not really interested in figuring it out on our own. And we assume there's a reason why things contradict one another, and so we don't focus on it. We don't really learn Tanakh, we just read Tanakh. And Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun's point is that in order to learn Tanakh, you have to approach it the way you would approach a Gemara, and you have to ask questions. When something stands out to you, when there's a contradiction, when something is written in duplicative form, you have to ask yourself why. And I want to give some examples. We could talk about the reasons, but the reasons are less important than what the examples start from. Let's start with the easiest one. Everybody knows that Parak Aleph in Bereishis, the Rav made this famous, but people knew it before him, and people saw it after him, and people said different things besides Adam 1 and Adam 2. But everybody knows that the description of Briyas HaOlam in Parak Aleph of Sefer Bereishis and the description of Briyas HaOlam in Parak Beis of Sefer Bereishis are inconsistent at a minimum, and in many ways are flat out contradictory. Now the question is, what do we do with that? So does it make me sound, it does make me sound a little irreligious to say that, right? How could that be? How could it be that things in the Torah are inconsistent? Doesn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu know how to tell a consistent story? There could be reasons, there must be reasons, but it would be very, very hard to ignore the contradictions. And this isn't something that was seen in the 20th century. Chazal, Rashi, everybody knew back then. When people learned Chumash for real, everybody knew that the order of creation in Parak Aleph and the order of creation in Parak Beis are different. So for example, when you have one parak that describes the creation of vegetation before, this is Parak Aleph, before the creation of Adam and Chava, and then you have the second parak that describes vegetation coming after the creation of Adam and Chava, so if you're sensitive to this issue, if you've seen it and it bothers you, then when you see Rashi quote Chazal as having said that, well, the grass grew right to the very edge of the earth, but it only came out when Adam and Chava were created, so that Rashi means a lot more to you. It doesn't make it any easier, and it's a very hard Maimar Chazal, but it's clear Chazal saw the contradictions and tried to resolve them. Okay? That's beyond a doubt. We didn't discover these contradictions, and we should stop apologizing for them, because they were known, you know, since the creation, since the Torah was written, and Chazal were all over them. Let's do a different one. How many times does HaKadosh Baruch Hu make a covenant with Avraham Avinu? This is nothing fancy. A major bris. There's only two of them, right? One is called Brit Ben Abtarim, and the other is Brit Milah. Right? So if you knew nothing, this isn't offensive, this isn't troubling. The biggest Haredi in the world knows there's Bris Ben Abisarim and Bris Milah. But who asks themselves, why did we need two? Right? Couldn't God have made whatever deal he made with Avraham Avinu in one bris? So it almost doesn't matter what the answer is. The question is much more important than the answer. The question has to be asked. Yes, Chazal do deal with this, and Chazal see what's consistent between the two britot and what's different. But if you never bother to ask the question, you're not in the game. And if you're not in the game, when you see these rashis and you see these mamari Chazal and you see these medrashim, they don't mean anything to you because you don't realize what they're trying to do. Unfortunately, Rashi never wrote in the question-answer format. Right? If Tosfos wrote Rashi on Chumash, then we wouldn't have to be so smart. Because Tosis would say, one second, in Parak Aleph it says this, in Parak Beis it says that, that's inconsistent. Here's the answer. Right? But Rashi never does that. And perhaps if Rashi, you know, was that verbose, he wouldn't have gotten as famous as he was. So there's a good trade-off. But the bottom line is he doesn't do it, so we have to be clued into it on our own. Okay. So far, two examples. One, Parak Aleph, Parak Beis of Bereishis, those are inconsistent. Bris Ben Absarim, Bris Milah, they're not inconsistent, they're just duplicative. That's the second type of question we need to ask. The third is just what I would call the human interest questions. Okay, and here's one of the most famous ones of Yoel Ben Nun. He didn't make his reputation on any one idea. But if he had one, like, moment of nevuah, I always thought this was it. Right, the question of why Yosef HaTzadik, having risen to be the prime minister of Egypt, never sent a postcard home to his father, who was mourning him, who was living in pain and agony, who was angry at his children, right? The psukim are clear that Yaakov was suffering greatly. Now, There's nothing inconsistent. There's nothing necessarily in the psukim that makes you ask, you know, how come Yosef didn't send a postcard? The only thing that makes you ask it is if you look at these people as being human beings. Right? If you think about your own life and your own children, and God forbid if you were in that situation, that's a third type of question. Right? Where he asks, nothing's wrong in the psukim. It just doesn't make any sense that a person like Yosef, having been so close to his father, would not at the first opportunity send word to his father telling him that he's okay. Now, does anybody know Rabbi Yoel's answer to this question? Anybody who's not a blood relative of mine? Who hasn't heard me say it five, you know? Okay, so listen to this, because I really think it's a perfect example of the way, you know, we need to read Tanakh, but the way we're incapable of doing it. And the reason why we're incapable of doing it is because we know the end story, right? We know what's going to happen in the end, so we've stopped reading the middle. If we could fast, if it was a movie, you know, we were just watching the good parts, we would fast forward Yosef and Mitzrayim, and we would just wait for the reunion with his father, right? But if you didn't know that, then you would be hanging on every page of the book. If you didn't know how many pages there were, you'd be hanging on every page, and you'd be nervous, and you'd be asking yourself these questions. And I'll tell you, I once heard of Moshe Lichtenstein say something that really spoke to me. He said, and Tal, you may have been there, because I think he said it last year. He said, you know, when his youngest daughter was in first grade, and she was learning Gracious with him, he was so jealous of her, because he thought to himself, I'll never ever learn Gracious again for the first time. You know, when you learn it for the first time, you read it. And you don't know exactly what's going to happen. So every pasuk means something to you. So to get back to Rabbi Yoel's point, what he said was, we're so sure that Yosef knew exactly what had happened. Right? He says, imagine this situation. He has all these proofs to it, which are necessary for this, but it's a long article. He bases this as follows. Yosef asks himself, he's sitting in jail in Egypt, and he asks himself, why doesn't my father, who's a pretty powerful, rich guy, send somebody to look for me? After all, my brothers sold me to the Egyptians, right? If he cared, he would come looking for me. And he has this idea that over time, Yosef becomes convinced of something that we never think about anymore. And that is that the era of choice has not ended. What does that mean? Avram had two sons, right? Avram had two sons, Yitzchak and Yishmael. Yishmael pushed aside. Yitzchak chosen. Yitzchak has two sons, Yaakov and Esav. Esav pushed aside. Yaakov is chosen. Now, Yaakov has 12 sons, it's true. But one of them is hated by the others, right? Yosef thinks to himself, maybe they've been lobbying my father all along. You know, I did make them all jealous. My mother's not alive anymore. They may have said, us or him. And I was sent away. My father knows exactly where I am, just like Avraham knew where Esav was, and Yitzchak knew where... No, Avram knew where Yishmael was, and Yitzchak knew where Esav was. My father knows exactly where I am. But I'm not the chosen son. And he has a plan. And his plan is, when the brothers come, the question is, you know, so the Ramban, by the way, the Ramban asked this question, right? Why didn't he send a letter? The Ramban's answer was he wanted the dreams to come true. And Rabbi Yoel thinks, why, you would torture your father for your dreams to come true? It's a strong question on the Ramban. And he says, basically, from the moment he saw the brothers, his plan was to get Binyamin there, the only one he could trust, to ask him, what's the story? Do I have a chance to ever come back home, or am I really kicked out? And what, you know, there's all these textual proofs, but the main one is, at the beginning of Vayigash, when Yehuda's arguing with Yosef, he says to him that his father would say, Vayetzeh ha'echad me'iti v'omar ach tarov torah v'lo re'isi v'adheno. And all of a sudden, Yosef thinks to himself, at this like this amazing moment, wait, he thinks I was killed, right? All these years, I thought he knew where I was. He thinks, and that's why he comes clean, and that's why he basically gets all emotional and says who he is. You could agree or disagree, but that kind of, you know, relationship to figures in Tanakh, asking those kinds of questions, leads to these kinds of insights, which again, It disagrees with the Ramban. Chazal didn't say. You could argue back and forth. But it gives you a relationship to Tanakh that you'll never ever have if you don't ask those questions. Sorry.
I just wanted to comment that Yosef's last contact with his father sending him in to a dangerous situation.
Absolutely. That's part of Rabiel's point. That why would he have sent me to meet the brothers when he knows that they hate me? Right? It all, you know, it all makes sense when you read it forward, but not backwards. Okay. Let's do one more. The first one on the sheet. It's Shmos Perek Chaf Dalet. Ve'el Moshe Amar Alei Al Hashem Atal V'Aron Nadav V'Avihu V'Shivim Mizikne Yisrael V'Ishtach Avisem Me'Rachok. And God says to Moshe, come up to the mountain. Vayichtov Moshe es kol divrei Hashem vayashkin baboker. He writes down everything Hashem told him. Vayiven mizbeach tachas ahar ishnei masrei ma'atzivol ishnei masrei shivtei Yisrael. He makes 12 mizbechot for the 12 shvatim. Vayishlach et na'arei b'nei Yisrael vayalu olot vayizbechu zivachim shlamim la'ashem parim. They bring karbonos. I skip some psukim. Vayikach sefer abris vayikrab bosnei ha'am vayomru kol asher divrei Hashem na'aseh v'nishma. Okay? When was this said? When did Bnei Yisrael say Na'aseh v'nishma? No cheating. When did, I'll give you two choices. Before Ma'amad Har Sinai or after Ma'amad Har Sinai? Okay, I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint. Ma'amad Har Sinai took place in Perek Yud Tes, Parashas Yisrael. Okay, this is Perek Chaf Dalet. It's the end of Parshas Mishpatim. When was Na'aseh v'nishma said? Before or after?
In Israel, it says Na'aseh.
Before or after? There's only huh? Okay, so the answer is we all grew up following Chazal, and look at Rashi here. Rashi says Vel Moshe Amar Alei Parshazo Ne'emro Kodem Aseres Hadibros. When uba arba'a b'sivan ne'emar lo alei, on the fourth day of Sivan, Torah was given on the sixth. Moshe was told go up. That's when Bnei Yisrael said Na'aseh v'nishma. Okay, that's what Chazal say. That's one position. Chazal, as is the Ramban, disagrees with this. It doesn't. The substance doesn't matter. If you're reading Mishpatim and you're not at least bothered by why it is that this is out of place, you're never going to clue into what Chazal are saying. Okay, if you weren't my wife, I would have to ask you to leave. If you're unaware of the fact, if you just read it and you go, oh yeah, this is Ma'amad Har Sinai, but you don't bother asking, what's it doing at the end of Mishpatim, even according to I'm not eating your cooking anymore. It's a big threat. Okay. If you're not bothered by why it's at the end of Mishpatim again, okay, Ein Mukdam Uruch HaBator. Can I tell you something? Ein Mukdam doesn't mean there's no order and it doesn't matter where things are in the Torah. They're moved for a reason, right? The Torah is supposed to be in order. Rashi thinks the Torah is supposed to be in order also. When things are out of order, they teach us something unique, something special. But if you're not clued into it at all, if you don't ask the question, so then, you know, you're just not in the game. None of this matters. So again, I don't have a view on whether the Ramban is right or Rashi's right, and whether, you know, it was in order or not. But I know that if you don't notice these things, and by the way, these aren't things that only great scholars can notice, right? Anybody who's paying attention to Chumash, this is as fundamental as it gets, right? When you see a Rashi, you can work backwards. When Rashi says, this is out of order, you have to say to yourself, okay, when did it take place and why would it have been moved here? And I'm not going into any of that because we don't have the time for it. All I'm saying is, when you talk about learning Tanakh hands on, it means noticing these things and asking these questions. Okay. Let's do another one. We're in Sefer Dvarim. Sefer Dvarim is full of contradictions. Right? Sefer Dvarim recaps a bunch of what went on in Shmos and a lot of what went on in Bamidbar. But it's inconsistent. Whose idea was it to send Meraglim? Okay? Whose idea? Well, in Parsha Shlach, the Pasuk says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, Moshe Shlach Lecha Anashim. Right? But in Bamidbar, Moshe describes all the people coming to him. Huh? In Dvarim, sorry. Moshe describes all the people coming to him, and Vayitav Beinai Adavar. I thought it was a good idea. these aren't subtleties. These are fundamental contradictions. And again, I don't think that we should shy away from pointing these out. I think Chazal were aware of them. Chazal dealt with some of them. But it doesn't change the fact that they're there. Let's do an easier one. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu not get to take the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael? Oh, come on. Yeah, something. Forget that. Because something to do with the rock. The rock was a very bad thing. Okay? Look at the psukim. Look at number two. Okay? Vayarem Moshe es yado vayachas asela b'mateu pa'amayim. Hits it the rock twice. Vayetsu mayim rabim v'teishtai do ubiram. Right? Water flows out. The people drink. At this point, it sounds pretty good. It sounds like he's successful. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe ve'al Aaron. Uh-oh. Ya'an lo ha'emantem bi lahakdisheni le'yei b'nei Yisrael. It's hard to know what it is, but we're not learning these tzukim right now. Because you didn't believe in me to sanctify me in front of the whole people. Lachein lo tavi'u es ha'kahal hazeh el ha'aretz asher nasati lahem. Therefore, you will not be able to bring these people into Eretz Yisrael. Again, Moshe Rabbeinu is not allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael because he hit the rock twice. Something to do with the rock. Okay? Next source, Moshe in Parshas Devarim says as follows. In the story of the Meraglim, oh, you know what? He wasn't just angry at you, Bnei Yisrael. He was angry at me. And therefore he told me, I'm not allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael. Excuse me? Right? Is Moshe making excuses? He was punished for hitting the rock. And he does it again. Also in Parshas Devarim. Next source. Devarim Gimel Chavav. Vayisaber Hashem bi lema'anchem. And God was angry at me because of you. V'lo shama elai. Vayomer Hashem elai. Rav lach, it's enough. Al tosef daber elai od badabraza. Don't ask me anymore. Right? This is Moshe begging to go in. Moshe says, you know why God doesn't let me go into Eretz Yisrael? Because of you. So I ask you. Right? What do you do when the story, the parsha says that Moshe wasn't allowed in because he hit the rock, and then Moshe, in speaking to Klal Yisrael, says it's your fault? Anybody want to make a suggestion? Yeah. Okay. Presumably, the answer must be along those lines, or more narrowly focused. There may be a different perspective in Dvarim than there is, you know, in Shmos and Bamidbar, right? Shmos, you know, it's a question of perspective. If Moshe is trying to give Musa to Klal Yisrael and prepare them to go into Eretz Yisrael at the end of his life, so it could be that, I don't want to say he exaggerates, but he focuses more on their role in the sin than on his own role. But of course it's true. Had they not complained about the water in the first place, had they not sinned with the spies, none of this would have happened. So technically it's true, but again, the answer matters much less than noticing the fact. And again, you don't have to be a genius, you don't have to be a Tanakh scholar to realize that the two stories are inconsistent. Okay. Now, if we actually adopt this approach, if we actually ask the questions that I'm suggesting we ask, what are we going to find? We're going to find three things. The first is, we're going to find that many of these questions were already asked by Chazal and Mefarshim. Okay? That happens for sure. Okay? Now, what happens when you notice this? Let me just share with you. I'm sure it's happened to everyone in this room. What happens when you see something and it bothers you, and then it turns out, right, that that's what Rashi was talking about. That's what the Ramban was talking about. That's what the Medrash was talking about. You know what happens? You feel pretty great. Right? You feel like you're an active player in learning Tanakh, and you're not just sort of going through the motions. And you'll remember not just the moment, but you'll remember the idea forever. Because it's your idea. Right? Because you had this moment where you saw something that Chazal saw. And Chazal were reading the same text we were reading. So there's no reason why it can't happen. It's an amazing feeling. And it's one that we should get more often. It makes Talmud Torah more personal. Now, that's the easy part. The other thing that happens when you ask these questions is that often you find that they're answered by the Torah themselves. If you just read the Psukim carefully enough, you'll see that there's a different perspective in Dvarim than there is someplace else. if you just read the psukim, and I'll try to give you examples of these, if you just read them as if you're reading them for the first time, sometimes the answer is buried right there. Not even buried, it's hiding in plain sight. It's just, we read psukim over and over again that we've seen since first grade, and we don't read them closely enough to start answering the grown-up questions that we're supposed to be asking. Okay. Now, it's so obvious that we should be doing this. Time for the other side, right? So why don't we do this? Why are people afraid to do this? Why do people tell you, you're not allowed to do this? Well, to some extent, because it's dangerous. On the simplest level, I'll say this. On the simplest level, there is the school of thought that says, if it was worthwhile, it's already in Chazal or in Mefarshim. If it's not there, whatever you're saying is wrong. Okay, it's a position. Nobody ever said that about a Gemara, right? Nobody ever said, well, it's not in the Ran, it's not in the Ritz, so you must be wrong. In a Gemara, we want to say original things. We're excited to say original things. We get famous for saying original things. But in Tanakh, we're afraid. Okay. Let me give you a source for the side that I suppose at this point I'm actively advocating. And this is one that Rabbi Yoel ben Nun quotes pretty often. Look at number 3. Anybody know who the Or HaChaim is? Okay, it's important to know that Or HaChaim, he was so famous for his piety and his sanctity that no one calls it the Or HaChaim. What do they call it? The Or HaChaim HaKadosh. Okay? It's a cool thing if that's your nickname. Now, he was born in 1696 in Morocco, spent time in Italy, finally in Eretz Yisrael, and he wrote the Or HaChaim on Chumash. And listen to what he writes on the first pasuk in Bereishis. You ready? It's number 3. This is a good one. This is a keeper. He says as follows: Da, no. Ki rishus lanu nisuna lefaresh mashma'ut hakituvim. We are given permission to explain psukim b'nisivos ha'iyun v'yishuv hadas, in the pathways of focused of learning and with common sense. Hagam, notwithstanding the fact, shekadmunu rishonim, that rishonim came before us, right? Notwithstanding the fact that Chazal and rishonim and mefarshim explained things, v'yishvu ba'ofen acher, and they had a different pshat. Says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, we have the right to see things in psukim using common sense and say a pshat in the pasuk, notwithstanding the fact that it didn't appear in Chazal and it didn't appear in the Mefarshim. Why? Ki ayin panim or shivim panim la Torah. Because we have to take seriously the idea in Chazal of shivim panim la Torah. Not every insight in Tanakh has been exhausted. The ain anu, listen to this. The ain anu muzharim shalolim tot mi divrei harishonim. We were not warned against straying from the words of the Rishonim. Ela beperushim sheishtaneh hadin lefihan. We're not allowed to change the halacha. I mean, you can't come along and say, "Hey, lo sevashel gedi b'chalei bimo." That has nothing to do with meat and milk. That you're not allowed to do. That's why we should be careful. Ulazeh v'lazeh tinsa shehamoraim ein kach b'mlachlok alatanaim b'mishpatei Hashem. That's why we know the rule that amoraim can't disagree with tanaim, and in theory, you know, rishonim can't disagree with amoraim, and achronim, except for the gra, can't disagree with rishonim. Right? Those are the rules. But he says those are rules in the halachic system. They're not rules in learning. But in learning pshat and psukim, matzinu lahem bekama mikomot sheyifarshu ba'ofen acher. But we often find later people who came and explained things in psukim differently than those who preceded them. The Ramban being the foremost example of somebody who, it doesn't bother him at all to disagree with Chazal. So says the Or HaChaim, you know what the rule is? On halachic matters, you're bound by what came before you. But if you take seriously the fact that there's shivim panim la Torah, then get in the game. Then you're allowed to, and you're supposed to. And maybe this is an important point to make. Right? Shivim panim la Torah, not shivim panim la halacha. Right? I don't have a right to disagree with the Shulchan Aruch. I could be as convinced as I want to be. I don't really have the right. But the Or HaChaim HaKadosh thinks I have the right to disagree with the Ramban. Now, obviously I have to be careful, and I want to give some parameters to this. But the bottom line is, if you're worried about the point that we don't have the right to say something that Chazal didn't say or that Mefarshim didn't say, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, wrong. We have the right, and perhaps even the obligation, and if we take Mamar Chazal seriously, we'll do it. Okay, now. Huh? I'm getting there. Yeah. There's obviously an overlap. You're absolutely right. But there's a narrow overlap, right? The question of why Yosef didn't write home to his father is not a halachic question. So says the Or HaChaim, you know, you can talk about that. The question of what the pasuk means, ayin tachas ayin, that's a narrow halacha question. And there you'd have to be very careful, because there you're bound by, you know, what Chazal said, what the Gemara says. There, you know, you're playing in a very narrow field. Okay, now, what are some of the obvious limitations? To say you could say whatever you want in the pasukim, of course we're bound by. What are we bound by? We're bound by our theology. We're bound by the fact that we're Orthodox Jews. So if the pshat that you want to say involves there being two gods, right? If the pshat you want to say involves there being a God who can't do something, who's unaware of something, who has a physical being, okay, then we're limited because we've accepted certain fundamental principles of faith that we're bound by. But beyond that, we're on our own. Except, it is dangerous, right? There's a big debate going on now in the blogosphere between, you know, okay, which we don't want to talk about tonight, but there's no question that it's dangerous, and I'm not here to tell you that it's not.
Could you finish the sentence? Because not all of us.
No, so every week that statement is true, just in a different context. There's a big debate going on in the blogosphere. This week it has to do with who wrote Sefer Dvarim. Next week it has to do with Netil Sadaim. More people are interested in who wrote Sefer Dvarim than Netil Sadaim. Okay? So the answer is, it is dangerous. So why should we do it? So some people say, well, you know, when your kids go to university or wherever, they're going to bump into Bible critics, and you know, and so better that you prepare them than they get it outside of the home. Okay, but then I'm kind of sympathetic to that. Let's not let them go to university, right? Then I'm really sympathetic to Charedim. If that's why we're doing this, I don't think that's a very good reason. I have to say, for me, we do it because it's the purest form of Talmud Torah. This is how we learn. This is the way, in my heart, I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to learn, right? If we're always going to be afraid of asking questions, we're not going to get very far, and it's not going to be very fun, and it's not going to be very satisfying, and we're not going to take ownership of Tanakh. We're not going to learn. So yes, it's dangerous. The question is it worth it? Yeah.
And you also implied that there may not be an answer. I mean, you don't believe that there isn't an answer.
Okay, we're getting there. But let's say it this way. I'm going to get to Rabbi Breuer in a second. But Rabbi Breuer always said, when he gave shir and people questioned him, he said, I'm learning the way Chazal learned. And Chazal learned without Chazal. Right? His point was, in order to have any understanding of what Chazal are saying, you have to read the Pasuk. Right? You have to engage with the Pasuk, and then all this other stuff will come and help you. But if you don't actively engage with the Pasuk, see, you're not really learning. I think it's how Chazal learned. I think it's how the Ramban learned. I think it's how Rav Kook learned. So I'm not saying we are all these great people. But certainly some of us aspire to be, and we want to play in the same game that they're playing in, and that involves doing this with all the risks. Rav Yoel Ben Nun once said, it's an interesting thing, he once said, you know, Nechama Leibowitz was famous for saying, what's bothering Rashi? Right? And it's a great question. But he always said, I'd like to ask a more primary question, like, what's wrong with the Pasuk? Right? Instead of asking, but why does Rashi ask this question, think of the question yourself. You could do it. And if you do it, you know, you're much more closely connected to the Pasuk than you would otherwise be. Just one quick other one that I once read from Rav Yoel. It's a classic one. You know the story when the Malachim come to destroy Sodom, and so Lot takes them in. I'm not going to throw away pasuk. It says umatzo safa vayochelu. He made the matzos, and Rashi quotes Chazal, you know, Pesach haya. So you could see the Rashi a million times. Okay, so it's Pesach. It doesn't really, you know. And Rabbi Yoel said, so my whole life I saw the Rashi 500 Pesach, you know. It doesn't ask a question. And then, like, one day he said, I sat down and read the parak from beginning to end as if I'd never seen it before. And he has, like, 20 examples of where the pasuk, like, hits you over the head about the house and the people come to the mezuzah. It all of a sudden reads exactly like Yetzias Mitzrayim. Now, you could do with that what you want. But if you just say, yeah, it was Pesach, because, you know, the answer is, Chazal could say what they want, of course, but Chazal read Psukim. And Chazal saw all these parallels between the Malachim in Sodom and Pesach, and that's what led them to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu hinting at Pesach there. So on the one hand, you can't say that if I don't see it in the Psukim, then I don't believe Chazal. God forbid. But the Maimah Chazal means so much more to you when you see what they saw. Right? It means so much more. Okay, now, having said that broadly, I want to focus on one last thing. And that's, again, when you talk about, you know, the Tanakh revolution, so there's all these big people, and there's Rav Mordechai Breuer, who sort of sits off on his own as one of the founders of it, but he, more than anybody else, he's known for one particular derech in learning Tanakh. It's called the Shitat HaBechinot, or aspects, and I'll try to explain it to you. But to do that, well, first of all, let me say, like, I was zochet to go to his shiurim. He was a huge Talmud Chacham. He was Rav Amital's Chavrusa in Hebron. He was born in 1921 in Germany. He is from the famous Breuer family. He lived till 2007. Okay? We need 2 minutes of biblical criticism in order to get to Rav Breuer. Okay? Biblical criticism started in 1753. I looked it up. Okay? There's some French guy named Jean Astruc, and he made up the documentary hypothesis. The first form of it was the following. There are two documentary sources that Moses, you know, sort of borrowed from in writing the Bible. One had a god by the name of Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, and one had a god by the name of Elohim. And that explains why there are all these inconsistencies, because it all tracks back to the two original sources, you know, that were tied to two different gods. 100 years later, Julius Wellhausen, in 1878, you know, he took this and took it a step further, and he made what people refer to as the documentary hypothesis. He advanced it to say there are really four sources. If anybody's joining the tape now, I don't believe any of this. I'm just, okay? There are really four sources, right? It's what's called, you know, J, E, B, and P. And very quickly, you know, J is the J of Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. That he had these, he broke it down literarily, like four different styles of writing, and also historically, they come from different periods in his theory. Okay, so J is the oldest source. It's Yud Kei Vav Kei. That's one source in the Torah. E is the Shem Elohim, right? Same as this French guy had, but he had more. D is the Deuteronomist. It's cool, right? The Deuteronomist, the person who wrote Devarim, who wasn't Moshe Rabbeinu in his theory, and P are priests, who the priestly sources who are responsible for almost all Sefer Vayikra. Okay? And obviously, you know, somebody tried to synthesize them but didn't do such a good job, took stuff from four different sources, so when things conflict, and they're copies of each other, whatever, it's because there are four different sources. Okay? Here's an English translation of a line from one of Rav Breuer's seminal articles. Listen to this. Rav Breuer says as following. These conclusions of biblical scholarship are based on firm evidence which can in no way be refuted. And anyone who seeks the truth and acknowledges the truth cannot deny the truth that arises from the words of these scholars. Okay? Here's the greatness of Rav Breuer, and here's how he changed everything about biblical criticism. He said, all the facts are exactly as they describe them. What they're wrong is the reason. Meaning, there aren't four authors, and there aren't four documentary sources, and they're not written in different historical periods. But they're right that it looks that way. And they're right that these things conflict. And he says, we're losing the game by arguing with them on the facts, because they're right on the facts. These things are inconsistent. there are contradictions. They're wrong on the explanation. And that's where he came up with the Shitat HaBchinot. Now, before I explain it to you, Shitat, the theory of Bechinot, of aspects. Okay? Just unrelated, but because it'll help. I have a brother-in-law, Professor Moshe Kopel, who's the head of some, like, you know, genius computer think tank in Bar Ilan, and they have this really cool software where first they could tell you if the author of something was a male or a female, like within like 90-something% accuracy. And don't get all excited. It has to do with prepositions. It has nothing to do with emotion or anything like that. And it works, right? Okay, that was like 5 years ago he had this. A year or two ago, he came out with a study. This was unbelievably, it was really big in Israel. It was in the newspaper here also. They basically came out with this the computer software that they had supports Bible critics. It breaks up Sefer Yeshayahu into the way that they would have broken it up if there were two authors. And it breaks up Chumash into the way that Bible critics break it up. So he was on the news and everything. And, you know, he's a firm guy. I continue to eat at his house, even after this thing. You know, and he's on TV there, and they're saying, so you're saying that there are multiple authors? So he says, no, that's not what we proved. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that what they discovered is true linguistically. That doesn't mean that there are multiple authors. It just means that breaking it up in the way that Bible critics suggest, they were right. They read carefully. Now, what's the Shitat HaBchinot? Instead of Breuer, and I have it on the sheet on the top of the next page, but I don't have it as a source, because when I looked on the Bar Ilan today to find the phrase Dibrat Torah Talashon B'nei Adam, it appears so many times in Chazal and in Gemara that it just seems silly to... Okay? What does it mean, Dibrat Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam? We believe this. So Rav Breuer said, it means that God didn't write the Torah in the way that He could write it. He wrote it in the way that man would write it. Okay? Now, what that means is the following. That sometimes, in order to get a complicated or a compound point across, the Torah writes it in two different and often conflicting ways. Because there's more than one truth, and there's more than one way. Because God can create the world twice. God can create the world with Midas HaRachamim and with Midas HaDin. But how do we see it, and how would we describe it? Man can only describe it one way at a time. We only know Din and or Rachamim. But the idea of both together doesn't mean anything to us. Okay? Let's try to do this inside with the example we started with. Okay? The conflict between Perek Aleph and Perek Bet and Breishit. Right? That's the classic example. So again, God created the world with which Shem Hashem? Bereshit bara Elokim. Okay? Look at the beginning of Perek Beis. It's number 4 on the sheet. Eile toldos ha-shamayim va'aretz bihi bara'am. Biyom asot Hashem Elokim eretz v'shamayim. Right? The first appearance of the Shem Hashem. Yud Kei Vav Kei. Rav Breuer didn't discover this. Bible critics didn't discover it. Jews have known it, you know, forever and ever. It just became a hot potato point later on. Okay? Now, the question is, right, so Bible critics will say, well, Perek Aleph was written by this God, you know, with a source from this God, and Perek Beis was written with a source from this God. But said Rav Breuer, no, they're just two conflicting descriptions that give us the total picture. What happens in Perek Aleph? What's the order of creation in Perek Aleph? It's completely natural. The Shem Elokim is nature. Okay? So, first, the sky and the earth and water and light and the moon and the sun, right? Then vegetation, then fish, then animals, then human beings. Okay? That's basically how it works. It's a form of God-induced evolution. I mean, that's how, you know, you would think. And man sits at the top of nature, but he's part of nature, right? That's all you have in Perek Aleph. There's not much about Gan Eden. There's no prohibitions. There's no commandments of man. it's just the natural world. Okay? Now you come to Perek Bet. Listen to this. And I'll tell you in the verse so you'll see it. In Perek Bet, when you have the Midas HaRachamim introduced, right, the world becomes a different place. And man isn't part of nature. Man is the focus of the world. Man is connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a way that fish and animals can and never will be. And man is given control of the world. Let's read. Pasuk Hey. V'chalsiach ha-sadeh terem yihyeh ba'aretz. Right? No vegetation yet. V'chal esev ha-sadeh terem yitzmach. No grass. Why? Ki lo himtir Hashem Elokim. Again, the Shem Hashem appears there. Al ha-aretz. Because it hadn't rained yet. What's the most important thing? Va'adam ayin la'avodas ha'adamah. What's the point of anything in nature if man doesn't yet exist? The whole world was created for man. Skip some psukim, pasuk zayin. Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adamah vayipach ba'apav nishmas chayim vayihi ha'adam lenefesh chaya. The first thing that's created in Perek Beis is Adam. Vayita Hashem Elokim, again, Hashem Elokim gan be'eden mikedem vayosem shom es ha'adam asher yotzar. Right, again, it's all about Adam HaRishon. He's planted in Gan Eden, and only then, pasuk tes, Vayasmach Hashem Elokim min ha'adamah kal eitz nechmad l'mareh v'tov l'ma'achol. All of a sudden, then you have beautiful trees and vegetation. And not only that, v'eitz ha'chayim b'soch adam v'eitz hadas tov v'ra. Right, didn't exist in Perek Aleph. Vayikach Hashem Elokim et ha'adam v'yanichehu b'gan Eden le'avda u'lishamra. Man now has a job. Le'avda u'lishamra is, he's in charge of making the world grow. He's in charge of the stewardship of the world. Right? He's in charge of curing cancer. It's a pasuk in the Torah. La'avda l'shamra means we are responsible for the world. And then, tazayim. Vayitzav Hashem lakim al ha'adam le'mar mikol eitz hagan achol tochel. Okay, eat anything you want. Ume eitz hadas tovara lo socham menu ki biyom achol chom menu mos tamos. Now we have a prohibition. Right? It's a completely different world. Vayikra ha'adam shemos l'chol ha'bayimo l'of ha'shamayim u'l'chol chayas ha'sadeh. U'la'adam lo matzah ezer kinyagdel. Only in Perek Beis does man have the authority to name the other creatures. It's a completely different world. And Rav Breuer says, the way what Chazal mean by Dibra Torah Kelashon Bnei Adam is, we can only read a story that describes one way at a time. So we read Perek Aleph, and we read the word about the creation of a natural world. Okay? Then we read Perek, and that's done. How do we know it's a different story? That's done B'Shem Elokim. Right? Then we have the Shem Havayah introduced in Perek Beis, and we read about a world created with Midas HaRachamim, where humanity stands at the center, in this really close connection with relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There are things we're supposed to do, there are things we're not allowed to do. We are the center of the world, we were created first, everything exists only for the purpose of man. It's a completely different world. Says Rav Breuer, the only way to get that kind of nuanced, complicated point across is to tell the story more than once. Right? It's not two authors. It's two perspectives. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu acting the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu can, and it's a difficult thing for man to understand that. But the only way to understand it is to see two contradictory descriptions or two inconsistent descriptions, because God could do that. Right? When we say Zachar v'Shomer b'dibur echad, it doesn't bother anybody. But we can't do that, and it's very hard for us to hear that also. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu can. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say two words at the same time, he could create two conflicting worlds at the same time. Now, I've thought about this a lot. How was it really created? Right? What was created first, trees or Adam? So that's what Chazal tried to answer by saying, you know, they grew a little bit, but not a lot, because you want to be able to tell the story, you know, in a coherent way. But there's no reason why the coherent way that Morichani taught us in kindergarten should be the way that we continue to learn it for the rest of our lives. Because we grew out of that, and now we're able to see contradictions that don't bother our emuna, but strengthen our emuna. Right? These things are all here right in front of us. Okay, I want to do one from this week's parsha. Okay?
Can I ask a question?
Sorry, yeah? Go.
Just a question. Does it have to be that they actually are two realities?
Or could it be that one is reality?
Yeah, I don't know.
One is more of a moral teaching about what you learn.
I would like to think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could create the world twice in a way that you and I can't understand. But I never heard Rav Breuer say that. Yeah.
What do the documentary scholars...
Oh, they got it wrong, meaning...
What do they do with Hashem Elohim being in the same place?
Yeah, so it's a different God. He has a different name. He has a different name, yeah.
So, if you go to the other case, you know what it meant. Like the rock, who sent the rock? Hashem Elohim.
Right.
So, you don't have to say that Hashem Elohim is quick.
No, you don't. This is... Right. You're right. The Ramban there really tries to tell the story. The Ramban on the Meraglim tries to tell the story. And he says there are two different perspectives. Right? Depends how you look at it. The Ramban basically says God was going to send the Meraglim anyway. It happened to be that Bnei Yisrael showed up first. Right? That's his explanation. But you're right. This is the example we needed to do, but you're right. In other examples, things happen one way or the other. But it's funny. I'll just give you a funny example that's not in the Torah at all. How did Avram Avinu, how old was Avram Avinu when he discovered God? It's not in the Torah. What did Chazal say? He was either 3 or 40. Those are the two dominant positions in Chazal. Well, there's a huge difference between if he was 3, then it came to him instinctively. If he was 40, he worked at it, right? So I often wonder, it's such an important part of the Torah. In fact, like in a way, it's the most important moment in the history of religion. The first monotheist, the first person to discover God. Why isn't it in the Torah? You know what I think? I have no proof to this whatsoever. Because we're supposed to be able to imagine it happening at 3, and we're supposed to be able to imagine it happening at 40. To some of us, the 3-year-old thing speaks, right? You know, that's the way I want to see. Everybody discovers God, you know, it doesn't have to have happened, or it happened in one way. But does that mean that Chazal were right in one medrash and wrong in another? No, because the Torah doesn't tell us, and my theory is the Torah doesn't tell us, because it wants us to be able to imagine it as having happened in two different ways. Those two ways conflict, but so what? Okay, let's do this week's parsha. A classic example of Rav Royer Shita. He wrote about this in a bunch of different places. Ready number 5. It's not such an exciting case. It's Eved Ivri, but it's a good one. Ready? Number 5. Ki machelecha achicha ha-ivri o ha-ivriya va'avadcha sheish shanim. If you have an Eved Ivri, he works for you for 6 years. Uvashana ha-shviyis tishalchenu chavshi meimach. And after 6 years, he goes free. V'chi tishalchenu chavshi meimach lo tishalchenu reikam. Don't leave empty. He doesn't leave empty-handed. Ha-anek ta'anik lo mitzoncha migonecha mikvecha sheber achla shem lekecha titeimach. You have to give him, you know, severance. Why? Remember that you were in Mitzrayim. Okay? You tell him it's time to go. He says, no, I love working for you. You take the piercing thing. Right? You pierce his ear. And he becomes your Eved for how long? No one reads Pesukim? No! What does it say in the Pasuk? Sorry to yell at you. Okay? But it's not fair to say it happened. That's what it says. It says forever. Does anybody see Yovel here? Anybody at all? No, it's not there. Le'olam. Okay? Where is Yovel? It's in Bahar. Okay, look at number 6. Right, this is a parsha that's repeated 3 times. It's in Mishpatim also, but we don't have time. We'll just do the 2. V'chi amuch achicha imach v'nimkal lachlo sabod bo avod asavod. Okay, don't treat him like a slave. Kis achir kis oshav yihye imach achna seavod yavod imach. How long does he work? Yovel. Okay, Yovel is every 50 years. V'yatzom imach hu uvanav imo v'shalom mishpato v'alachazas avosav yoshuv. Why? Ki avodai heima she'oseisi osam eretzitzan lo imachu mimker asavod. Okay, because we belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we can't be sold forever. And then another example, V'chisasig ya ger v'sashov imachu macha achichima, and he's sold to you, acharei nimkad yulati yalo achad me'achab yigalenu, we should try to redeem Jews who are sold into slavery, the closest relative should do it, go to Pasuk Nun, how much do you pay to get him out? V'chishavim koneh, you have to do the math, mishnas imachu lo achnas hayovel. Right? You divide by 50, or how many years are left till the Yovel? You buy them off for the divided, the remaining portion of the sale price. But in any event, he leaves in the Yovel year. Why? Okay? Bible critics did not discover this flat-out contradiction between this week's Parsha in Re'eh that says Va'avodo le'olam and the Psukim in Bahar that say he only stays till Yovel. Lovely, lovely. So it doesn't bother you at all. Okay, it's an answer. And Chazal have plenty of answers, and I didn't quote them here only because I'm less interested in the answer. The problem is, right, why would the Torah, so Bible critics say, it's proof, right? In one source, you were supposed to be a slave forever, and in another source, you're supposed to get out of Yovel. There's tons of other contradictions, but I just want to focus on the one. So Rav Breuer says, they're right. Meaning, it looks that way. They are in conflict, right? No matter how much you want to, you know, your answer is a good answer, but you can't say it's Shuto Shel Mikra. The Pasuk says Le'olam. Okay? So listen to this. This is what close reading, now we'll put everything together, this is what close reading can do. Rav Breuer says, the key to any contradiction lies in the purpose of each parsha. Okay? Look at Parshas Bahar. Look at number 6 first. Why are we not supposed to be slaves? What does the Torah say? Find a pasuk. Pasuk Mem Beis. Ki avodai heim asher otzeisil sam eretz sam lo yimachurim keres aved. God says, right? I took you out of Egypt to be slaves to me, not to be slaves to other people. Right, and this beautiful Chazal, why that, you know, Ozen Shemal Arsinai Kiliv Yinei Sol Avadim, all right? Chazal, we're all over this. So the reason why we can't have slaves forever is because God says people belong to me. And the pasuk appears again. Last pasuk on the page. Kiliv Yinei Yisrael Avadim Avadai Heim Asher Otseisi Yosem Eretz Yisrael Ani Hashem Elokeichem. I took them out of Eretz Mitzrayim to be slaves to me, not to other Jews. Okay? What's the reason why slaves go free in Parshas Re'eh, in this week's Parsha? Anybody could have seen this. Believe me, I didn't see it either. But, okay? What's the reason why? Pasuk Tezvav. Everybody there, number 5? V'zacharta ki eved hayisa be'eretz Mitzrayim. You, the master, should remember that you were a slave in Mitzrayim by Yiftucha Hashem Elokecha. The focus in this week's Parsha is on the master. God says, you know what it was like to be a slave. Why would you keep slaves when you know what it was like to be a slave? Therefore, I'm commanding you, the master, to send the slave away at some point. Now, what's the point at which the slave goes away? So far I haven't said anything. All I pointed out is that there's a different focus, right, in the two parshios. Okay? Now, here's the good part. The two sections, the two parshios, complete each other, but cannot be said together. Why? Because you're saying to yourself, well, why didn't God just put both together in one parsha so we wouldn't be confused? So the answer is, because they're two completely different ideas. Meaning, one idea is that mankind are not supposed to be slaves. God was kona us, he bought us when he took us out of Mitzrayim, and we are not supposed to be slaves. And because of that, at some point, right, the slave has to go free. The focus is on the slave, has nothing to do with the master. Right, in the other parsha, in Bahar, the focus is on the master. I'm sorry, in Re'eh. The focus is on the master. You should know, having been a slave, right? So if it said it both together, we would say, well, the reason why a slave has to go free is because, on the one hand, we're supposed to be sensitive to it, we having been slaves ourselves. On the other hand, right, as a completion of that idea, is the fact that God owns us, having taken us out of Mitzrayim. The verse said, no. Those two things are two completely separate ideas. You have to let the slave go because you're supposed to know better, Mr. Master, right? Having nothing to do with that or in conflict with that, you, the slave, have to go free because God owns you. You're not owned by anybody else. Those are not complementary ideas. They're conflicting ideas. We don't see them that way, but they are. And to put them together would weaken each one. We would think that they're, you know, they're both working towards the same goal. Now, it's an interesting idea till now. How does it help us? Listen to this deal. This I find staggering. And, you know, maybe one day regular people could do this. If the focus is on the master, right? This week's Pasha's Ray, the focus is on me. Why do I have to let my slave go? Because I'm supposed to remember what happened in Mitzrayim. So at the end of 6 years, I tell the guy, listen, it's been fun, but you got to leave. What does he say? Pierce my ear, and I'm going to stay. Says Reb Breuer, in Pashas Re'eh, when the focus is on the master, I've done my mitzvah. You know how long he should be my slave? Le'olam. He should be my slave forever. Because when the focus is on the master, and when you read through the psukim again, as I hope you'll do, you'll see the focus really is on the master. All the psukim talk about the owner of the slave. So I did my part. And if it was only for Pashas Re'eh, in this bechina, in this one aspect, he would be my slave, le'olam. And the pasuk says le'olam because it means forever. But there's another parsha in Bahar. And there's a completely different understanding. And the different understanding is, don't focus on the master, focus on the slave. And he doesn't have the right to give up his freedom forever. He gave up his freedom, he got his ear pierced. Nevertheless, comes HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, I'm not going to let this go past Yovel. So Reb Breuer says, it's a complete contradiction. And when you and again, the Bible critics are right in the sense that it's a complete contradiction, but they didn't discover it. Chazal knew it, Mefarshim knew it, everybody knew it. The question is, why was the Torah written, why was the Parsha written twice? And if you read carefully, this is what I said at the beginning, Psukim answering themselves. If you just read these Psukim over and over again in this week's Parsha, it just jumps out at you that the focus is different than the focus in Bahar, and the focus is different than the focus in Mishpatim. This is what Reb Breuer means by the Shitata Bechinaut. Things are in conflict, but they're in conflict for a reason. The conflicts that Bible critics point out, they don't weaken our understanding of Tanakh. They are the beauty of Tanakh. The inconsistencies are all to show, you know, Achas Diber Elokim Shnayim Shamanu, that there's more than one aspect to look at it. There's more than one way to see it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have written it in one narrative, and he could have written it without the conflict, but we human beings would have lost the point, right? Two extremes lead you to see something that writing about it in the middle, right? Love and hate, as it was, or love and justice, you know, midas harach, midas hadin, to put them together doesn't give you the same idea, saying, no, there's midas harach and there's midas hadin. And Reb Breuer does this tens of times in the Torah, and each time, you know, you're staggered by what you haven't seen in the simple reading of Sukkim. Many times it gives color to what Chazal already said. Many times, like here, I don't think you could find this in Chazal, but I'll go out on a limit. I don't think Chazal would have been offended by this idea. Meaning, he's not here to say that the halacha is wrong. La'olam ultimately does mean Yovel. But that's the halacha. That's not the reading of the pasuk. The reading of the pasuk is much more beautiful when you can see both sides. Okay, let me finish with the following. We're done. I'm out of time. But let me make two last points, if I could, about sort of what I think came to me over the last 3 weeks. We started with the history of Tanakh study, right, and the cycles of Tanakh, and when we focused on it, we didn't. It dawns on me that we're still coming off sort of like a down Tanakh period, right? From, you know, 1750 into the 1900s, there wasn't a lot of Tanakh stuff going on. But it's changing. And the question is, you know, are we going to have the confidence to keep pushing this forward, right? To feel like we want to relate to Tanakh, and God forbid, I'm not saying it should replace Gemara, Torah Shabbat, nothing like that. I'm just saying, you know, when you learn Parsha, when you learn Chumash, when you learn Tanakh, do we want to have the confidence to push forward what I think, you know, a process that, if it continues in 50 years, if I gave this lecture series, no one would understand what I'm talking about, right? Because everybody would learn Tanakh on a level, and people would relate to it, where they wouldn't even understand what I'm saying. As I assume, if somebody gave a talk about the importance of Tanakh during Bayis Sheni, that would be nonsense, because that's what people learn, right? Not in replacement of anything else, but just because in the history of our people, living in the land of Israel and going through the historical cycle we're going through now, you know, lends itself to coming back to Tanakh and being comfortable with Tanakh and seeing those things hand in hand. But a second thought I had, and it could be completely wrong, but why I think we ought to invest in this more than we're doing is, and maybe it's just because I live in Israel, Tanakh is the bridge, or it seems to me will serve as the bridge between us and Chilonim. Right? When you have a non-religious person come to your house on Shabbos, what do you talk to them about if you want to have a conversation? You know, a substantive conversation. You don't talk to them about, you know, halachos of Asher Yatzar. Right? And they're also, you talk to them about the Parsha. And what do? They read Psukim. You know, in Israel, everybody talks about Tanakh as being the Sefer HaSfarim. When Avner Netanyahu, the son of the prime minister, came in second in the Chidon HaTanakh, right? Okay, well, either you hate the prime minister, so it's great his son lost, you know, or it was the whole, you know, everybody was into it. It was a very exciting thing. And I don't believe that Avner Netanyahu, I'm not saying, well, I don't believe he keeps Shabbos the way we do, right? The fact that there are people like this, who, I promise you, Avner Netanyahu knows Tanakh better than anybody in this room. And why not? Why should that bother us? It's the greatest thing ever. And it's, you know, the suspicion that irreligious Jews have of Torah Shabbat Al Peh doesn't exist with respect to Torah Shabbat Chsav. So, if for no other reason than the historical cycle we're in and the value of Tanakh, I feel like, you know, the more we did it, the more we would have in common with Jews all over the world. There could come a time where, you know, we could quote Tosefta's and Zvachim, and Jews in Brazil will be excited by them, we'll be able to talk about it. But that time's not yet. Right? But Psukim in Tanakh is what binds us. And I assume that, you know, when Tanakh was written, that was part of it. And the sooner we get back to it, the better. I thank you very much.
And,
okay. We'll dive in Marv in 1 minute.